Good to be here with you for a Bible study. We're continuing our survey of the major prophets, getting on a little further into the book of Isaiah today. Picking it up here in Isaiah chapter 15. Now, this section of Isaiah primarily concerns prophecies against specific Gentile nations as well as some directly against Israel. And we will, it sort of concludes with God's intervention in human affairs and the description of the time when God's government will hold sway during the millennium. One of the themes that runs through the prophets, and certainly that runs through Isaiah, is the theme of God's sovereignty, that God is the ruler, that God holds sway over things that in a way that certainly goes beyond anything that can be discerned just purely on the human level. One of the things that ties in with this, of course, the background or the setting here of the book of Isaiah and of Isaiah's prophecies, they're set at a time when the Assyrian Empire is rising to its peak of power and prominence. At the beginning of Isaiah's prophecies, the Assyrian Empire was beginning to come into ascendancy there in the Middle East and gradually expand out. Isaiah began, of course, his prophecies in the last day of the last year of King Uzziah and continued on then through the subsequent kings, Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. And so Isaiah's prophetic ministry took quite a number of years, and it was during these times that Assyria was on the rise and conquered northern Israel during the beginning of this, and on through later on in Hezekiah's reign, Assyria made incursions all the way down to Judah. Now, in the process of this, there were various other nations that were, involved. And what Isaiah is showing here in this particular section is that each of these nations that have been traditional enemies of Judah and Israel, the surrounding nations, that God is going to visit punishment on them. But that's not the end of it, because you see, God is going to continue to deal with these various peoples until ultimately God intervenes to set up his own government. It was important for people to understand that all of the things that were happening in the world around them were not simply based on time and chance, who had the biggest armies. It was not just based on the affairs that they could see. Rather, that God was working out a plan and a purpose, and that God ruled supreme over the nations. Now, much of what Isaiah describes in these chapters, beginning here with chapter 15, as he starts out in chapter 15 talking about Moab, continuing on down through chapter 16, chapter 17, focusing on Damascus, chapter 18, the area down in the, let's say, the headwaters of the Nile, which would refer to Ethiopia and even some of the lands on beyond that, such as Uganda and Kenya and East Africa, chapter 19, dealing with and 20 dealing with the with Egypt. Isaiah shows God's intervention in dealing with those nations, and that was all fulfilled in a typical way by the Assyrians coming in. But these prophecies generally go beyond that to show the time of the end time. Chapter 15, for instance, starts out with the reference here to Moab, and describes. Now, the Moabites and the Ammonites are people that have really not moved very far from where they were anciently. You know, you go back and you read the story in Exodus and Numbers, and you find out they were there on the west bank of the, or on the east bank of the Jordan River. That's where Israel dealt with them as they came into the Promised Land. And you know what? They're still over there, right in the same vicinity, and things are stirring along. If you, by the way, just on an additional note, if you've kept a note of the news down in South Africa, the situation is even more churned up as far as what is being, that the whole focus of this whole conference is now turned to focus on Jerusalem and on the state of Israel. And it's sort of interesting, just reminds you of some of these things. It's about as close to all nations being gathered together against Jerusalem as any thing that you can foresee. Obviously, a prelude to a military event that will happen in later, you know, a few years yet. But anyway, we start out here with dealing with the Moabites. And the fact that how God would deal with them, and the punishment that would come upon them, and that's of course what happened at this time period as the Assyrians came through, devastated much of that. Now in this context, chapter 16 then addresses verse 1: "Send you the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah unto the wilderness, unto the mount of the daughter of Zion." Now, Selah is, in fact, in my Bible, there's just a little marginal note. It says Selah or Petra. And many of your Bibles will have a similar note. Selah was the Hebrew equivalent of, let's say, actually Selah was the older name, so I guess you could say Petra is the Greek equivalent of the old Hebrew name Selah. Selah is the term used in the Old Testament. Petra is the term we commonly use today because basically, that's the term popularized by the Greek geographers. Now, there's a focus here. Selah, or Petra, of course, is in the modern-day Kingdom of Jordan. Areas there of the Moabites and the Ammonites. But chapter 16 introduces something on beyond that, because it... than just what was happening anciently. It talks about the Moabites, the daughters of Moab at the fords of Arnon. It talks about people who have been cast out or who are refugees. And it says, "Take counsel," verse 3, "execute judgment, make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcasts, betray not him that wanders. Let my outcasts dwell with you, Moab. Be you a cover to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land, and in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging, seeking judgment, and hasting righteousness." Now, when you look at the end of verse 4 and verse 5, it's pretty apparent that we're talking about something that goes beyond the events of the Assyrians coming in and making incursions into the area, because we're looking at a time when the spoiler will cease and the oppressors will be consumed and the throne will be established, the throne of David. Well, that in context is really looking at the end time. So just as there were disruptions in that whole area at the time Isaiah was writing, Isaiah looked beyond the disruptions of his day and focused in on something yet future. And this is one of the verses, as probably you noted in I guess the most recent Living Church News. There was an article there dealing with the subject of a place of safety, and this is one of the sections that seems to be the most clear that has indicated over the years to us. And you might be interested to know we're not the only ones who've ever drawn the conclusion of Petra being a place of safety. There are others who have noticed that. Because, frankly, if there's any hint in the Bible as to where it is, that's the only place I'm aware of that's hinted at. I'll grant you that there are not, you know, as many just real plain, clear-cut scriptures giving all of the ins and outs and details as maybe most of us would like to see. But God does address Moab in the context of the end time, saying, "Let my outcast dwell with you, Moab." Well, who are God's outcasts? Who are God's outcasts? Be a cover to them. And then the focus here, it talks about make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Well, what does the shadow do? You know, if little animals are hiding from birds of prey, what do they do? If you get in the shadows, you can't be seen. You know, a hawk or something is circling around overhead. Well, if they can spot something down right in the in the clear sunlight, boy, they'll swoop down and get it. Little animals, scurry around to try to get in the shade, get in the shadows, hide under something so that they can't be seen. Shadow, as make your shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. In other words, here, that's descriptive, sort of a poetic description of offering cover to someone, making it being, in that sense, protection. So, in the context of the end time, this is one of the verses that has certainly called our attention to Petra. And he goes on and talks about the pride of Moab and how ultimately, as Isaiah prophesied, verse 14, "Now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be condemned." So, if you date this, by the way, chapter 14, verse 28, the date is the year that King Ahaz died. This would date down to the time that Assyria did come in. King Ahaz evidently died in 715 B.C., and by 712, the Assyrians had come in and had completely overrun that area of Moab. So Isaiah was prophesying of events that were at least a typical fulfillment in his day, but the overall sense of it also ties in with the end. Chapter 17, the burden of Damascus. Damascus is taken away from being a city. It'll be a ruinous heap. Damascus was a great city-state, of course, up north, and is today the capital of the modern nation of Syria. And Damascus was one of the areas to the north that certainly fell to the Assyrians as they came in, and they did destroy Damascus, and it became a ruinous heap. And so Isaiah talked about that. You see, calling attention to the people who were listening to his prophecies that God ruled in the affairs of men, that God could determine ahead of time and did determine ahead of time what would stand and what would fall. Comes on down, and it says in verse 9, "In that day shall his strong cities be as a forgotten bough and an uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation, because you have forgotten the God of your salvation and have not been mindful of the rock of your strength." So it describes here the problems that were going to come. And you see, the tendency of people, and the tendency of the people in Isaiah's day, was to look to some of these foreign nations that if we can make an alliance with them, they will protect us. You know, we'll get this thing together and we'll manage to... the Assyrians have done this, but they won't be able to do that. And Isaiah was showing them, or God was showing them through Isaiah, that you can't put your trust in the physical things, physical alliances and intrigues. That's not going to solve the problem. You're going to have to look to God. And Verse 12, woe to the multitude of many people which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nation shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they'll flee afar off. You know, you can just sort of hear almost the imagine this army moving in and sounding like the rushing of many waters as you hear the, you know, from a distance, the rumble of the troop movements and the cavalry and the chariots and the marching infantry, and it sounds like the noise of the seas. You know, it's this big roar you can hear in the distance. Seems impressive to people, but it's not impressive to God. Then he talks about because Assyria continued on down. You see, they continued on down into quite a ways south. He says, woe to the land shadowing with wings beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sends ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes upon the waters, saying, go you swift messengers to a nation scattered and peeled, to a people terrible from their beginnings hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see you when he lifts up an ensign on the mountains, when he blows a trumpet, hear you. You know, the Egyptians were seeking to get ready. I mean, historically, the Egyptians were seeking to fend off an Assyrian invasion. And so they sent ambassadors, sent emissaries on down, way on down into East Africa, down into Ethiopia, and even beyond that. This people that are sort of described on the very outer limits. The King James renders it a nation scattered and peeled. That's sort of an obscure statement. The marginal rendering is a people outspread and polished. If you've ever seen pictures of Watusi warriors, you understand that this is a very good description. I mean, that's literally, they were noted way back. They're the tallest people in Africa. And they're still at it. You know, you heard about the Rwanda and all the war and the Tutsis and the Hutu. Well, Watusi simply means the people of Tutsi. So it's, they're still down there. They're still going at it. And they are a people terrible from their beginning hitherto. They're not the ones you want to tangle with. They have been have had that reputation, and the Egypt was trying to recruit. You see, they were trying to recruit all down through East Africa, put together this army. It's also described, interestingly, as a nation measured out and trodden down. They have gone through their share of difficulties. Well, Egypt was trying to put this alliance. They were going to blow the trumpet. Well, God said, I will take my rest. I'll consider in my dwelling place So he describes that before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, the sour grape is ripening in the flower, he shall both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. They shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth, and the fowls shall summer upon them, and the beasts shall winter upon them. So he compares this alliance Egypt was trying to put together. He says, you know, I'm going to come along with pruning hooks and all this stuff's going to drop off and be like, just what the animals are going to use. In other words, it's not going to come to fruition. It's not going to accomplish anything. And he goes on, looking on into a future. In that time, you know, in a future time, shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts of this people outspread and polished from a people hitherto terrible from their beginnings hitherto. They're going to come to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion. You know, looking on into the future, here were these people, these wild tribes, as they must have seemed to the people of the Middle East, that Egypt was trying to recruit and put together this alliance to fight against the Assyrians. Well, what Egypt was putting together was going to fall apart. And the time was going to come ultimately in the future when these people would come up, but they weren't going to be coming up as warriors. They were going to be coming up to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, to Mount Zion. They're going to be coming up seeking to learn about the true God. And I'll tell you, there's probably not going to be very many folks that are going to be any happier to see some of that being established, because when you look at the terrible things that are happening and have happened in that area of the world, the relief that the kingdom of God is going to offer, I suspect that some of the ones who've suffered the most and have had the most difficulty are probably going to be some of the first to send ambassadors. You know, it talks about early in Isaiah about many nations coming and saying, let us go up to the house of the God of Jacob. We want to learn of his ways. You know, there are going to be those who are rebellious and say, I'm not going up there. God will deal with them. There are others that are going to volunteer and say, you know, I'd really like to learn. I want some of what they have, and I'm going to come up there and ask them if they'll please teach me. It's sort of interesting, different attitudes that different peoples of the world will have. You know, Ezekiel describes how some of the Asiatics, Gog and Magog, are going to look and say, you know, that place looks pretty defenseless to me. Why, they don't even have bars on the gates and locks on the doors. All we got to do is just go down there and pick it clean. Boy, are they going to be in for a surprise. You know, when God's there, you don't need locks on the doors and bars on the gates. They'll find that the Lord is the one who can take care of all that. See, there are those who are going to draw the wrong conclusions. They're going to come up and think, we'll just take what we want. There are others, such as Egypt, that are going to refuse to come to the Feast of Tabernacles. They don't want all that old Jewish stuff. And yet there are others who are going to come. They're going to want to be the first in line. They're going to say, please come and teach us. Then chapter 19, see, goes on in about Egypt. The Lord rides upon, this is the burden of Egypt. The Lord rides upon a swift cloud and comes into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved. The heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it, and I'll set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. They'll fight everyone against his brother. Verse 3, the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I'll destroy the counsel thereof. So he comes on down. I'll give the Egyptians, verse 4, over into the hand of a cruel lord. A fierce king shall rule over them. And it talks about drought and the river being wasted and dried up. And when it talks about the princes of Zoan in verse 11, that's one of the great cities of Egypt. So he's describing the various areas of Egypt. And, you know, this happened anciently in terms of what God did with the invasion of the Assyrians, and how the Assyrians, in verse 4 of chapter 20, lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, and describes the you know, what was going to happen. So there was a terrible invasion that took place, and what the Egyptians were seeking to do collapsed. They weren't successful at all. Now, his statement in chapter 19, verse 4, the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord. A fierce king shall rule over them. Well, that was prefigured with what the Assyrians did anciently, historically. When you read the book of Daniel and you read about the invasion of the king of the north into the Middle East, he pours into the glorious land, and it says the land of Egypt shall not escape. So ultimately that cruel lord, that king of the north, is going to rule over Egypt. And that, you know, the Assyrian king really was sort of foreshadowed that. Talks about the events in Egypt, chapter 19, verse 2, where it talks about the civil strife, the internal difficulties. You know, that's one of the things that is besetting a lot of these countries over there right now, is the internal strife. And you've got a dichotomy in several of the Middle Eastern lands. You have it in Egypt between, let's say, middle-aged and older folks who are a little more secular and Western-oriented, but you have a huge number of young people. You know, that's one of the things that has happened. There's been a population explosion in some of those areas. So you've got a huge number, disproportionate if you compare it, let's say, to any Western land, of young people who are in their late teens, early 20s. One of the things that has happened is that Muslim radicalism, the radical Muslim approach, has become drawn a lot of attention to among the young in some of these lands. You know, if you go back to when Egypt achieved independence in modern times in the 50s, when Nasser led a coup that overthrew the King Farouk of Egypt. Nasser tried to set himself up. You know, if God had been looking for volunteers to be king of the South, Nasser was the first guy to have his hand up in modern times. He was volunteering. Nasser put together, if you remember, a union. Didn't last real long, but he put together a union of Egypt and Syria, which he renamed the United Arab Republic, and he was the president of it. And they were attempting to link Libya in with them. And when Gaddafi overthrew the king of Libya, one of the first things he did was make a pilgrimage to Cairo to visit Nasser and to offer, in effect, to join Libya with it. One of the things that you find about men like Nasser and realize that the president Nasser is not that far removed. Sadat was Nasser's handpicked successor, and Mubarak was Sadat's handpicked successor. So you're only this is only the second leader that Egypt has had since Nasser died, and they were proteges. They were Muslim, but not real seriously religious. There, it was more of a secular Muslim approach. They were looking at trying to modernize, catch up with the West, cut some of the things, traditions of the past. Today in the Arab world, there is a dichotomy between some of these leaders. When you look at someone, even in Iraq, see, Iraq is more of a secular state. Now, leader over there doesn't mind, Saddam Hussein doesn't mind stirring up religious unrest, but he doesn't want it in Iraq. And he basically wants to run things the way he wants to run them. And the clerics have a minor role. But one of the things that has happened is that starting with the Ayatollah Khomeini and the revolution in Iran, a militant version of sort of hyper-religious Muslim activity has really gained a foothold with the young in a way that generation ago in the 50s, the young people were looking at religion as what had kept their nations backward and made them subservient to the West, and that they had to embrace a sort of Western secularism. They tended to be attracted toward communism and the Russian model. They had to embrace that in order to modernize. Otherwise, you know, they would always be dominated and controlled by the West. So there is a dichotomy in most of the Arab nations right now between people who are middle-aged, who tend to be not necessarily pro-Western, but who have embraced some of Western secular culture and business and making money. And you got a lot of younger people who are coming up. The economy is bad. They don't see themselves as being able to go into the job market very well. And they have been stirred up. The movement of their generation is this militant religious approach. And so it is part of the problem that exists in the Arab world, and it's part of the strife that exists internally in these countries. And it is it's really like a time bomb waiting to go off. There is a lot of pressure because once you stir people emotionally and you get them all charged up and proclaim a holy war, How do you sit down and be reasonable and sort of negotiate some settlement? So anyway, sets the stage a little bit for what you describe, what is described here in as you look at end time implications of what's described in Isaiah 19. Now, ultimately, we're told that the time is going to come, and how that verse 20, the Egyptians are going to cry to the Lord because of the oppressors, and he'll send them a Savior, a great one, and he'll deliver them. That hasn't happened. The Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. They'll vow a vow unto the Eternal and perform it. The Lord will smite Egypt, he'll smite it and heal it. And they will return to the Lord, and he'll be entreated of them. And in that day there will be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. How amazingly far-fetched that must have seemed when Isaiah announced that. Because if there were anybody that were enemies of Israel, it was Egypt and Assyria, and they were also enemies of each other. And Isaiah is looking down the time. The Egyptians now... Zechariah makes plain it's going to take a little persuasion for the Egyptians to do all this, but the Lord will smite them. And, you know, a couple of licks doesn't do it. Well, he'll run them back through again, and when he gets through smiting, then he'll heal it, and they'll return. And ultimately, you know, it is a description of what's going to happen as to how nations that have hated one another, have been enemies, are going to learn to serve God together. And Egypt and Assyria and Israel are sort of singled out. I think I would take the implications of this that the Germans and the Egyptians are going to be the two greatest of the Gentile nations in tomorrow's world. You know, right? They'll be sort of mentioned, linked here with Israel. And you know, that it's interesting because anciently the Germans were the ones who led the migration into Europe. The city of Trier in Europe has an inscription, and I've seen it there in the city square, the Latin inscription that dates back, that proclaims that Trier is the oldest city in Europe, that it was founded by Ninus, king of Assyria. And they openly acknowledge that and proclaim that and date it to a time about 200 years after the flood, approximately 1,300 years before the founding of Rome. Came Ninus, king of Assyria, here and founded Trier. And you literally walk through the gates that Emperor Constantine rode through. And, you know, the Germans led the original migrations into Europe and were responsible. In fact, many of the peoples who came there, the Slavic peoples of Europe, the Germans brought them there. That's where they got the name Slavic, which is the root word means slave. They came there as slaves of the Assyrians, and that's where they got the name Slav or slave. And our English word slave is derived from the word Slav. That was the word that had entered. That was where the word comes from. So as you look at some of those things and you realize, okay, they were the ones that people that led the earliest migrations into Europe and were played a major role there. Egypt is the place from which basically if you study the culture and you study Africa, you realize that basically everything in Africa spread out from Egypt. Including, that's why you find the various brands of paganism you can trace back to Egypt. And so here are nations that were responsible for teaching others the wrong way and for going about settling and dominating areas and spreading the wrong things. After Christ returns, they're going to be beacons and spread right things. And instead of paganism flowing from Egypt on down and infesting everything else, it'll be the place, the logical place. It's right up there, borders Israel. It'll be the place from which right knowledge and right culture come in. So as you come on down and talks about Tartan, who was the general. This is Sargon was the king of Assyria, and talks about the this time, this invasion. Chapter 21 deals with the burden of the desert of the sea, comes on down and talks about the Elamites and the Medes, and how that they're going to the problems that are going to come here, and this is a grievous vision. Chapter 21, verse 2. The treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the spoiler spoils. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All the sighing thereof have I made to cease. And so it comes on down, and you, verse 9, behold, here comes a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen, and he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he's broken under the ground. Well, who ultimately is going to be responsible for the things that for the fall of Babylon? This phrase, by the way, from Isaiah 21:9 is the one John quotes back in Revelation 19. Babylon is fallen. Only John is clearly referring to the end time. There was historically a collapse. And the Babylon was conquered, and it was the Elamites and the Medes that played a role in that. They're evidently, when you understand that they're basically in the Slavic area, the area of eastern, some of the Slavic areas of Eastern Europe, the Medes very likely in the many of the descendants of the ancient Medes in the area of the Ukraine. You begin to put the story together, and you realize that though there will undoubtedly be alliances at the beginning, that ultimately this mixture of iron and ceramic clay is going to begin to fall apart, and that the as it talks about even in Revelation, you know, that the kings who have given their power to the beast are going to come to hate the whore. They're going to realize as everything begins to fall apart, and the setting of Revelation 19 is right at the very end. That is already after the Revelation 19 is set after the seventh trumpet is already blown, and the plagues are being poured out and all that sort of thing right at the very end, and you find this undoubtedly what's going to be an attack. Revelation 19, what it describes is, I think, very clearly a nuclear attack on Rome, because when you describe people seeing afar off the smoke of her torment rising up and being afraid to get close, I mean, the description given in Revelation 19 certainly makes you think of the mushroom-shaped cloud. That's what happens. So we find that events that happen in this day, the fall of Babylon, the burden on Arabia that comes here, the Assyrians invaded this whole area. And then chapter 22, the burden of the Valley of Vision, that, what ails you now? Here it describes the verse 5, it's a day of trouble, of treading down, of perplexity, by the Lord God of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and crying to the mountains. Talks about the Elamites. It talks about, various ones. And just as some of these came up against Judah anciently and were turned back, they were part of the Assyrian army. And Shebna and is mentioned here along with Eliakim and Eliakim, and you find if you go through the story back in 2 Kings that these were two of King Hezekiah's chief men. They were involved in the negotiations with the Assyrians, and you find that one of those is described here as having the idea that he was Shebna, who was over the house. He was the one who was that King Hezekiah had as like the royal chamberlain, and that he was pretty self-assured. He thought he was had everything taken care of, and was advocating certain policies that were contrary to what God was trying to get the king to do through Isaiah. And so Isaiah told him, the Lord's going to carry you away with a mighty captivity, and you're going to die. And Eliakim, verse 20, is going to be clothed with your robe, verse 21. Both of them are mentioned in the account back there in 2 Kings, where it describes, and in 2 Chronicles, where it describes the interaction of Hezekiah and the Assyrians. Says Eliakim is going to be clothed with your robe, and I'll commit your government to his hand, and the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, verse 22. He'll open and none will shut, and he'll shut and none will open. There was the royal chamberlain in, actually bore as a part of his badge of office, actually bore a key there, and it was the large old-fashioned type key that was actually used. He was the one that was the keeper of the keys. It was the position of highest authority under the king, because he was the guy that had the key to the king's treasure. Well, you're not going to give that to just everybody. He was the one that could go and come that you had to go through in order to get in or get out. He was the one that had oversight. He was the man under the king and had he exercised government, a government role. Christ quotes this in a description of himself to the church at Philadelphia back in Revelation 3. He is the one who really has the key of David. You see, the key of the house of David, the historical aspect of it, was King Hezekiah, of course, was the ruler on the throne of David, and the key of the house of David was the right to exercise authority from the throne of David. In the literal sense, Eliakim had that delegated to him by the king. Christ has that delegated to him by God the Father. And Christ is the one who will ultimately sit on the throne of David. And so he is the one. I think it is descriptive, really, in it ties in the whole context here, ties in with government, ties in with the proper exercise of God's government. Shebna sought to ensconce himself. He had maneuvered around, and he thought he was he had hewed out a sepulcher on high. He had thought he was protected. He was there. He was in. Nothing could get rid of him. And God said, oh, yes, it can. You're going to be hauled off in captivity, and I'm going to put Eliakim in your job. And that's, of course, what happened. The chapter 23 is the burden of Tyre, and again Tyre, the great city-state that dominated a lot of trade and commerce. You know, Tyre was the mother city for Carthage, and Carthage, of course, was in North Africa. You realize there's an inscription, by the way, in that area of the vicinity of Carthage. That describes some of the early settlement of that section of Africa, and it's interesting because it describes it from let's say the other viewpoint. It was put up by remnants of the Philistines and some of these that were, and their the Canaanite tribes that were driven out of the land of Israel, and the inscription says, here we came when we were driven forth by Joshua the robber. Well, who did they consider Joshua the robber? See, it's a matter of perspective. But anyway, Carthage was a colony of Tyre. Carthage, if you remember, your history became later the rival of Rome for the domination. It describes in chapter 23, verse 1, the burden of Tyre, how you ships of Tarshish laid waste. Now, Tarshish was a Phoenician colony on the coast of the Mediterranean coast of Spain. That's where the ships of Tarshish, they plied the whole Mediterranean, Tyre on the east coast of the Mediterranean and Tarshish on the west coast, there on the coast of Spain. And so it was this great trading combine. And it describes that, you see, and what they've heard, and council is taken, verse 8, against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants were princes, and what God is going to do, that in verse 11, he stretched out his hand over the sea, shook the kingdoms. The Lord has given a commandment against this merchant city to destroy the strongholds. And so it talks about that. And of course, Tyre was. And it says in verse 13, behold the land of the Chaldeans. That played a major role, that Tyre was what takes place. Chapter 24, the Lord makes the earth empty, turns it upside down, scatters abroad the inhabitants thereof. So it really, when you read the context, it goes beyond what the Assyrians did and refers to the end time. But there is a section here that is misquoted. If you ever read Ellen G. White and her writings of the Seventh-day Adventists, their teaching is that during the millennium, the saints will be with Christ in heaven for 1,000 years. They'll be having the investigative judgment. They'll get up there. They'll get to read the books. They'll find out everything they ever wanted to know about what their neighbor was doing. There'll be the investigative judgment. Well, Christ doesn't need all the Adventists up there to help him investigate what everybody's been doing. And their teaching is that the earth is empty. See, Satan is bound by circumstances. The earth is absolutely empty. The saints are in heaven with Christ for the 1,000 years. Well, she quotes, if you read, she only quotes part of the verse. She quotes in the great controversy, Isaiah 24, verse 6. Therefore has the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned. Period. But that's not what it says, is it? There's a comma, and it says, and few men left. See, she quotes Isaiah 24, 1. The Lord makes the earth empty, makes it waste. Just quote part of that. Well, as he comes on down, he talks about scattering abroad the inhabitants. She quotes part of verse 6, curse has devoured the earth, the inhabitants of the earth are burned. Well, if you just quote those parts of the verse, it sure sounds like everything is empty and wiped out. But if you go through the context, it describes an area that is desolate in which few are left. God's judgment that in verse 21, you see, or verse 20, the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, shall be removed like a cottage. Things that are going to happen that we don't, can't fully imagine, but we know from historical times that even in historical times that the earth's axis has shifted. That's a different story, but it ties in that the polar axis was not always exactly where it is, evidently some of that is going to happen. There's going to be the earth literally wobbling in its orbit as some of these things begin to happen. In the day of the Lord, the heavenly signs. In verse 21, it'll come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And talks about the moon being confounded, verse 23, and the sun ashamed when the Lord of hosts will reign in Mount Zion. So the events of the day of the Lord. Chapter 25, now he's been talking about God's judgment, and now he begins to talk about what God's going to do. That you've made, chapter 25, verse 2, you've made of the city a heap, of the defense city a ruin, but that's not the end of the story. Verse 6, in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the feast of fat things, feast of wine on wines on the lees of fat things full of marrow, wines on the lees well refined. He'll destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, the veil that is spread over all nations. You know, God's going to lift the veil off their eyes. They'll be able to understand the truth. These are verses that we it starts with the millennium and comes right on down to the time when he'll swallow up death in victory and wipe away all tears from their eyes. Well, that's quoted in Revelation chapter 21. So the story, you see, in just about three verses, we run through the entire millennium and on into the white throne judgment and the new heavens and the new earth. It'll be said in that day, verse 9, this is our God. We've waited on him. He'll save us. And chapter 26, verse 1, that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. And talks about that, God's power. And it says here to as it comes on down and looking even in verse 19 to the resurrection when the dead men will live, verse 20, come my people, enter into your chambers, shut your doors about you, hide yourself as if it were but a moment until the indignation be overpassed. The Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. So that's referring ultimately to the events of the day of the Lord. And then chapter 27, in that day the Lord with his sword and strong, great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent. Leviathan, that crooked serpent. Well, Leviathan, is used, or the dragon, the serpent, is used as a type of Satan. And Satan is going to be what's going to happen. In Revelation 20 says that Satan is going to be taken and bound. He's called that old serpent, the great dragon, that old serpent, Satan the devil. God is going to bind him for 1,000 years, put him away. So it describes in that day, speaking of the day of the Lord, when God will punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent. And then what is he going to do? Verse 6, he's going to cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. You know, the Israelites will be regathered from captivity, and they'll multiply and begin to spread out all over once again as a colonizing people. Now, it's interesting, and we often read over this. Chapter 27, verse 1 opens, in that day, God's going to punish the serpent. Verse 13, and it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem. You know, we think in terms of the trumpet being blown at the Feast of Trumpets, and that's right. It was, and we read of that. But do you know that there was a trumpet that was sounded, there was a special trumpet sounded on another holy day other than trumpets? It was not sounded every year on that holy day, but it was sounded once every 50 years on the Day of Atonement. The Jubilee did not begin on the Feast of Trumpets, the first day of the seventh month. It began on the Day of Atonement, the 10th day of the seventh month. The Jubilee was what? Leviticus 25, you proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Interestingly, that's the inscription on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. It's a quote from Leviticus 25. You'll proclaim liberty, sound liberty, proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Well, when is liberty going to be proclaimed? Well, the Jubilee, according to God's law, the trumpet of the Jubilee is to be sounded on the Day of Atonement. And I think there's a very clear reason. Jubilee involved freedom. It was a proclamation of liberty. How can you have liberty until the enslaver of mankind is bound up and put away? True liberty will be able to be proclaimed. And one of the first things that happens, you see what happened when the Jubilee was proclaimed? People returned to their heritage. They came back and received, the property came back once again, that the slaves were freed and the property reverted back to the original owner. What's going to happen? What's described here in verse 13, I think if you take Isaiah 27 in context, that you would place it chronologically in Revelation 20. You see, Revelation 20 starts out in that day Leviathan is going to be dealt with. He's going to be punished. That's Revelation 20, the first three verses. The Jubilee is proclaimed. The captives are regathered. And you usher in the millennium a few days later, you see, with that. You ever thought about the fact that when you regather captives and you bring them there, that what are they going to be dwelling in? Temporary dwellings. So you're ready to... it's going to be Big Sandy on a grand scale. And when the trumpet that proclaims the Jubilee, that proclaims liberty throughout all the land, when that sounded, they're going to come that were ready to perish in the land of Assyria and the outcasts in the land of Egypt. They're going to worship the Lord. The captives, when liberty is proclaimed, that means the captives are let loose. And they're going to be regathered. Let's see here. Chapter 28 continues on down. Woe to the crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower. And describes the what's going to happen here, as it describes what's going to happen to Ephraim and how that... I think the description of how they've erred through wine and through strong drink, verse 7, is certainly descriptive of the role, the significant role that alcohol and drug abuse have played in the deterioration and corruption of Western society. And you look at the role that sort of thing plays. Then it goes on down, who will he teach knowledge, verse 9? Who will he make to understand doctrine? Well, it takes those who are mature. See, you got to be drawn from the milk, weaned from the milk, drawn from the breasts. Paul uses this analogy in Romans and Hebrews 6. See, he's quoting that. What does that mean? Well, precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. You've got to put it all together. It takes maturity to understand how it fits together. You've got to grow and mature a little bit spiritually. And as you do, you gradually are able to put the thing together. And ultimately, that's who is going to understand... That's the way the Bible is written. That the word of the Lord was unto them, verse 13, precept upon precept. And if you're blinded, you don't understand it because you've got to pull it together from all over. He says in verse 16, I'll lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. Clearly referring to Jesus Christ. And chapter 29, Ariel, the poetic name here referring to the city where David dwelt. And the Assyrians, of course, did come all the way to Jerusalem and surrounded it. But God intervened and delivered. And the indictment is delivered, verse 13, for as much as this people draws near to me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me. Their fear is toward me is taught by the precept of men. I'll proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. The wisdom of their wise men will perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hidden. And woe to them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who sees us? Well, that's pretty dumb. You know, somebody thinks they're going to get by with something God will never notice. But over the years, we've seen that. People think if they can keep people from finding out that they're okay. Verse 24, they also that erred in spirit shall come to understanding. They that murmured shall learn doctrine. People are going to be brought to repentance. Chapter 30, woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord. They take counsel, but not of me. They walked out to go down to Egypt. There were many in Judah at the time when they were threatened by the Syrian invasion. They wanted to make an alliance with Egypt, and Egypt could help them. If they could get together with Egypt, they could withstand the Assyrians. Well, you know, Isaiah's just finished delivering. Says, you know, Assyria is going to march right on into Egypt, and they're not even going to stop. They're going to head right on down to Ethiopia. They're going to take them captive. They're going to do what they want to do. But this attitude, you see, that people had, verse 7, the Egyptians shall help in vain to no purpose. It's a rebellious people, verse 9. And the thing that's there. What do people want? They said to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. You know, they want somebody to help them sort of feel good about themselves. They don't want somebody standing up and telling them their sins. Speak unto us smooth things. And that is the attitude. Well, it looks on down to the time when God will be gracious. Verse 18, he's a God of judgment. Blessed are all they that wait on him. And verse 20, though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. Now this is evidently talking about us during the millennium. You know, this time in the future. And the time when the people will be, talks about in verse 23, the bread of the increase of the earth, it'll be fat and plenteous. Your cattle shall feed in large pastures, a time of prosperity. And a time when God, the Lord, will cause, verse 30, his glorious voice to be heard. And through the voice of the Lord, verse 31, the Assyrian will be beaten down. And God goes on with that. So again, the indictment in verse 31, or chapter 31, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, that stay on horses and trust in chariots. You know, this indictment, this was one of the big things that was going on, the pressure on Hezekiah from Shebna and certain ones to get into this alliance with Egypt. You know, the only way we can withstand Assyria is by entering an alliance with Egypt. Well, how did Judah really withstand Assyria? God sent an angel and wiped out Sennacherib's army, didn't he? But here is this contrast. You see that ultimately the battle that God's people, one of the battles that God's people have always faced, is this junction of faith and fear. Are you going to follow the way of faith, or are you going to follow the way of fear? Are you going to try to protect yourself and enter into human strategies, or are you going to look to God and trust him? What are you going to do? Judah was confronted with an invasion. What were they going to do? Well, God said it's a pretty futile thing to get tangled up with Egypt. They're not going to make it through this. So he says in verse 3, the Egyptians are men, not God. They're horse flesh, not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, both he that helps shall fall and he that that helps shall fall down. And they'll all fall together. Verse 5, as the birds flying, so will the Lord of hosts defend Jerusalem. Defending, he'll deliver it. So turn you, verse 6, unto him from whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted. You see, the key to salvation physically for the nation was to turn to God and not to be doing what they were doing. He looks forward in chapter 32 to a time when a king shall reign in righteousness and princes shall rule in judgment. A stranger is going to be a welcome sight, verse 2, because a man will be like a hiding place from the wind, as rivers of water in a dry place. You know, that's not the case now. Comes on down and it says when's this? Verse 15, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, the wilderness be a fruitful field, the fruitful field counted as a forest. Judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, righteousness remain in the fruitful field, the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. My people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, sure dwellings, quiet resting places. See, descriptive of when is that? The millennium, the time of the Messiah, when a king shall rule in righteousness. Chapter 33, you see, woe to you that spoiled when you were not spoiled. That the Assyrians were going to, they were going to be punished for what they've done. Those conquering nations that have come in, God says in verse 5, the Lord is exalted, he dwells on high, he's filled Zion with judgment and righteousness, wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of your times and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. You see, the ambassadors of peace, verse 7, are going to be all disappointed. The highways will lie waste, and the earth mourns and languishes, verse 9, and now will I arise, verse 10, says the Lord, I'll be exalted. So, it'll be a time when the sinners in Zion are afraid, verse 14. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who's going to survive that day? Verse 15, he that walks righteously, speaks uprightly. Verse 16, he'll dwell on high, his place of defense shall be, the King James renders it, the munitions of rocks, the strongholds of Selah, which again, one of these references. Look unto Zion, verse 20, the city of our solemnities. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle not taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall be removed, neither shall the cords be broken. But there the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams. The Lord is our judge, verse 22. Well, that's a description of the time leading up to and after the return of the Messiah. That's when you'll see Jerusalem a quiet habitation. You're not going to see it a quiet habitation between now and then, the thing that takes is these events. Isaiah, you see, focuses in on the destruction, the punishment that's going to come, but he looks on beyond that and says, God is the judge. And ultimately, God's Spirit will be poured out. When Zion is filled with judgment and righteousness, mentioned in chapter 33, verse 5, what is it that makes for stability? Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of your times. You know, one of the reasons why this world, this society is so unstable? Because wisdom and knowledge have been cast out. Wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. You see, you go back to the book of Proverbs and you read about wisdom and knowledge. That provides stability. When in the world tomorrow, when a society is based on wisdom and knowledge, there will be stability. You know, it's important as young people grow up, and by the time they hit adolescence, you know, they go through a time where, on the one hand, their feelings, their emotions are certainly destabilized, all the hormonal changes that are taking place in their body. If they don't have something solid to anchor to, if you don't have a source that you can go to, it's like everything is thrown up for grabs. The subject of wisdom and knowledge is a very important subject. Why is Proverbs addressed to a young person? Basically, to an adolescent. If you really read the setting, it's Solomon's advice to his son, and you don't get the idea that his son is not somebody that's old and gray. His son is a young man. His son is let's say, on in that period of adolescence, young adulthood. His son is at that period of life where he needs what? He needs wisdom and knowledge, and that wisdom and knowledge will give him stability. Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept if you put it together and look at it in the context of something that is very important to provide for young people. And this verse points back to Proverbs and the principles of Proverbs as being a source of stability for young people who are going through a very unstable time in their own lives, and they're not, in our society, they're not getting stability from the society around them. The whole society, everything's thrown up for grabs. Nobody seems to be sure of anything anymore. And there's only, if you don't have God's Word where you can hang on to something that gives you something that's solid, then everything becomes confusion. It's one of the reasons our society is becoming increasingly less stable, because there's increasingly less wisdom and knowledge. Chapter 34, come near, you nations, to hear, hearken, you people, let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world and all things that come forth out of it. See, here's not something just to Judah or to Israel, this is everybody. The indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, His fury upon all their armies. He's utterly destroyed them, delivered them to the slaughter. It's the day, verse 8, of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. But it's going to culminate, you see, in chapter 35. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad. The desert will blossom, rejoice and blossom, blossom abundantly. And it talks about, in the end of verse 2, they shall see the glory of the Lord and the excellency of our God. Strengthen you the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, don't be afraid. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, even God with a recompense. He'll come and save you. The eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped, the lame man will leap, the parched ground will become a pool. And it talks about there's going to be a highway, verse 8. It'll be called the Way of Holiness. Won't be the LBJ freeway. It's going to be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. And it shall be for those. The wayfaring man, though fool, shall not err therein. I look at that sometimes. You know, you get into some of these big cities and you don't have to be a fool to err therein. You can get so tangled up. It's sort of like the old song about the guy who got on the MTA and would he ever return? No, he'd never return. He was lost on the MTA. You can get tangled up and turn every which way but the right way. You know, God's way, in terms of His way of life, is simple, and when He builds highways in the world tomorrow, they're going to be simple too. Directions are going to be simple. It's not going to be confusing. God's way of life is not confusing. The truth is not confusing. You know, that was one of the first clues to a lot of people back several years ago when you started coming out, you know, some of these folks started coming out with all this gobbledygook that you couldn't make heads or tails out of. Wait a minute. There's a problem with that. The truth makes sense. You know, most of us remember, when you first read some of Mr. Armstrong's booklets, it made sense. It was plain. It was simple. There it was. Then something started coming out and, well, you couldn't make heads or tails. What is this? You know, is he for it or against it? That is typical of the world. And people get confused and they get lost therein. Well, when God's way of life is the way of holiness, and He's going to build highways in the world tomorrow, and the one that leads to Jerusalem is going to be the way of holiness, and that's the way people come up to the feast, and it's going to be real simple, real plain. It will be, in that sense, typical of His whole way of life. The ransomed of the Lord will return, and they'll come to Zion with songs, verse 10. Everlasting joy upon their heads. They'll obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. It'll be a wonderful time. So Isaiah, we come to a break here, and we'll pick up chapter 36 next time, which is a historical inset that actually tells of some of the historical context of the things that we're reading about. See, God through Isaiah was telling the people that they needed to repent and look to God. He's the judge of the nations. And ultimately, God's government is going to be set up, and all these competing human governments are going to be swept from the scene. Well, with that, we'll come to the conclusion here this evening. We'll pick it up next time. And I've got study questions on the next...